Welcome to Smoking Section, a podcast by Eternal Dragons, a digital archive that emulates nicotine-filled rave break conversations to reflect on Asian diasporic identity, the arts, and culture. I'm your host, Miles, aka DJ Oyasumi. Today we're joined by Osmanthus, aka James Clay. James is a writer and DJ currently based in Seoul. He mainly writes for Bandcamp and The Wire magazine, and DJs a mixture of club styles, rave music, game/anime OSTs, and guitar pop. Welcome to the pod, James.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, so for a lot of the episodes so far, we've started with talking about where people grew up, and I guess like early memories of Asian identity formation. So yeah, I'm curious because I was reading your Organ Tapes mm-hmm. piece and you talked about growing up in Connecticut, but I think the phrase that you used was coming of age in Orange County. So that's an interesting contrast, and I'm curious about how that felt for you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I grew up in this really, I guess you could call it rural town in Connecticut, and probably one of the only Asians in, you know, my school. Kind of a, I guess it's kind of a common story, but then when I moved to California, it was very different. I went to Orange County, and almost like everyone was Asian. It was probably like 50-60% Asian. Yeah, so when I was growing up, I guess my only references to Asian Americanness was just other kids of professors who lived in the town I lived in. So it was just like Chinese Americans, like, you know, your dad's professor, and then you meet up every Friday because your parents are playing poker or something, and you just kind of like get together as kids in the basement playing MapleStory or something. So that's sort of what I knew as, like, we call those Asian parties, but it was pretty much just like, you know, Chinese American kids. And then when I moved to California, that's when I like met a lot more diverse Asian, I guess, people, if you can put it like that. And it really opened my eyes. Like, I didn't know what boba was. I didn't like watch K-dramas, or like, I didn't understand any of this stuff. And back in Connecticut, I was just like, kind of watching anime surreptitiously, hoping no one would find out that I'm like so like weird for watching anime. But I don't know why I was so self-conscious about that, but yeah.
How long were you in Connecticut for then?
I was until I was in seventh grade. Yeah, so like around 11, I think. And then so I came of age, like became, I guess, a real person, if you can call a high schooler that, in California.
So yeah, so what was that shift going to Orange County, and I guess what was the experience for you having more Asian people around you? Was it positive? Was it just like different, like encountering different kinds of people?
I mean, I think I never really had that, like, you know, lunch meet story in Connecticut even, because my parents didn't pack me lunch. So, I mean, I think I had a, and especially because I had these different, like, Chinese American friends, and then I had my whatever friends I were making at school. I always had this sort of, like, weird pride, like, not pride for being Asian, but, like, I guess it was, actually this was during like kind of the tail end of like the Asian pride stuff, so like I think Yeah, something like playing MapleStory with my friends on the week like weekends, and really embracing the fact that I was Asian in a weird sort of like looking back at it like self maybe orientalizing way or self exoticizing way, like, oh, like I'm yellow, ick, and what, kind of thing. And then when I moved to like California, I was like, I guess, yeah, I'm not that special. There's like a lot of like Asians out there, and actually don't know a lot about the Asian American experience. But I mean, that wasn't stuff I was thinking about because I was like 11, but I think maybe subconsciously I was like, yeah, but it felt good at the same time. I remember I was only supposed to go back, go to California for maybe half a year, like for a semester, but then I ended up staying because I could like choose if I could like stay with my mom or like go back and live with my dad. So I was like, yeah, I actually really like California, and I looking back, maybe it was because I felt more comfortable. Or maybe the fact that, you know, it's California versus like rural Connecticut. I mean, back then that's all I knew, and so I was like, I really don't want to leave, like, fuck California, I love Connecticut. But then I mean, I moved to California, I was like, damn, like I've seen the world.
Yeah, so what was high school like for you in Orange County? You said your school was kind of like maybe 50% Asian.
Yeah, so it was sort of like right next to the University of California. I was in, this is where I like, yeah, I was in Irvine, so
Irvine. Okay,
yeah,
gotcha.
with all the, you know, connotations around that. But yeah, so it was very like high powered public school if everyone's like trying to get in college. But yeah, I mean, high school was, I guess, when I first started listening to music seriously. My first encounters with music were in Connecticut, and that was mainly just like, you know, listening to the like top 40 soft rock radio that my parents loved, and then sometimes encountering a song that, you know, I would like. And actually, my first memory with that was with Green Day. I heard it on the radio, but like, I was maybe in kindergarten, and
Oh,
it
snap.
was Boulevard of Broken Dreams. But back then, I didn't know like how you could find out any of this information. So like, every time it would come on, I'd tell my brother like, "Oh, you're like Thomas. I heard the cool song today. I just knew about this as like the cool song." Then I don't know how I found it, but then yeah, I was like, "Oh, I was like, oh, this is Green Day." So then I had like my huge pop punk phase and growing up, Fall Out Boy and stuff. And then in California, that's when I encountered like, I guess, alt rock radio, which is like, whoa, this is crazy. I'm hearing this stuff like all the time now. It was like K Rock in SoCal.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, that was just like, you know, Smashing Pumpkins, like Silver Sun Pickups. They were playing a lot. But then, so halfway through high school, my brother introduced me to like, I guess, online music communities like 4chan and Reddit and Pitchfork. I learned what music journalism was for the first time. So then I started getting more into music. But I guess back to high school, like, yeah, I think in high school, I said before that like that's where I became a real person, but I think I was still always like, because I have an older brother that's 2 years older than me, so I kind of like followed everything he did, and had a lot of the same friends, or at least like I would just hang out with him because I didn't know how to make friends.
Gotcha.
But yeah, I think because everyone was Asian, like, and had all these different Asian American experiences, I kind of felt in a weird way like outsider to that because I didn't like have the same references to like, you know, all the things that Asian Americans talk about these days, like boba and like K-drama and K-pop. But I just thought it was interesting. Yeah, I mean, so
Yeah, I felt like my high school experience, Like, my high school was also super Asian because I lived near Stanford, and like the public schools there are really good, so there's a lot of Asian kids. But my parents are both third generation Asian American, so their families have both been in California for generations. So a lot of the kids I went to school with were like first or second generation new immigrants. And my experience was being surrounded by people who look the same as me, but not having the, like, I feel like the running jokes would be the self-deprecating, oh, my tiger mom, blah, blah, blah. Oh, I got a B+. And I couldn't relate to that because my parents are actually like,
right,
supportive,
yeah,
and didn't care about grades. So it was a weird experience. I don't know if it felt in some ways similar to you, maybe,
yeah,
because you spent some time in Connecticut.
Yeah, I think my parents were also pretty chill. I mean, pretty chill. So I totally feel that. Like, they just kind of let me do whatever I wanted. But as long as I, like, I mean, they wanted me to get good grades, obviously, but it was never really like an ultimatum. So, yeah, like, I did improv in high school. I remember my dad being like, what is that? Is that like stand-up? And like, he's like, okay, fine. I was like, if you want to do it. And yeah. So I, even though it was like the same generation, like, my upbringing had made me have different like references, I guess. Mm. And
were most of your friends Asian in high school?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Asian, a lot of like Iranian, a lot of, yeah, because there's also a huge Iranian like diaspora in like that area.
Yeah, so I feel like high school, at least for me, is pretty formative, like, music taste shaping time. So
Yeah. You're
kind of alluding to finding online music communities, and
yeah,
like, what kind of music were you discovering, and what was that, how did that kind of journey progress for you?
Yeah. No, I remember, like, I was hanging out with my brother, and he was like, yo, there's this cool band that, you know, wasn't very appreciated in his time. It, like, it got panned by Pitchfork back in the day, but then, like, now it's, you know, everyone loves it. You should listen. I'm like, oh, cool. And it turned out it was Neutral Milk Hotel.
Classic.
I was like, wow, this is some like ancient knowledge that my brother's imparting upon me. But it's just, so it was a lot of, starting out, it was a lot of like, you know, MuCore stuff, like basic. I was really into The Microphones and like Sufjan Stevens and like all these, I think I wrote about it a little bit, but like, yeah, all these like white dudes with guitars, like Nick Drake, Elliot Smith.
Yeah.
And then, but then, so I was like going on radio every time. I mean, I still kind of do this, but every time I encounter a new artist, or like, I'd, you know, go on RateYourMusic.com to see like, you know, what albums should I listen to out of their discography. Mm. It was nice to like use that as a reference because I really didn't know anything about music. And then I'd be pleasantly surprised, be like, oh wow, this thing I listened to before is actually like, yeah, pretty highly regarded. But back then I put a lot of like emphasis on like good taste and like, oh, it has to have whatever rating on Rate Your Music to like for me to listen to it, to be worth listening to. So that was sort of like that era. So yeah, everything Radiohead, I guess this is when like Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly was out, so I listened to that
right.
a lot. And The Life of Pablo as well, going into senior year. But yeah, before that, I was listening to a lot of prog rock, actually, in like eighth grade. And I was like, oh, I'm so like smart for listening to stuff with weird time signatures. I really liked At the Drive-In as well, because I liked the Mars Volta. And then I still like them a lot, actually. But yeah, I mean, I think my music taste before I discovered, you know, context for music was very all over the place. Like, yeah, prog rock, a lot of like alt rock station stuff like Incubus had a huge phase. And yeah.
What a beautiful face I have found in this place that is circling all around the sun. What a beautiful dream that could flash on the screen in a blink of an eye and be gone from me. Soft and sweet, let me hold it close and keep it here with me. And one day we will die and our ashes will fly from the aeroplane over the sea. But for now we are young, let us lay in the sun and count every beautiful thing we can see. Love to be in the arms of all I'm keeping here.
And so how did you kind of, what was the progression for you to get into electronic music and club music? Like, when did that happen and how did that happen? Was it also through your brother?
No, actually, so it's funny because I'm about to like show my ass here, but I actually haven't really like been listening to that stuff for very long throughout college. So around the same time, like senior year of high school, I was listening to my brother's college radio station. So that really made me want to listen to, do college radio when I went to school. So he did KSDT, shout out. But yeah, so all throughout college, right, I was doing college radio, and there I joined, they had different departments. So I joined the punk department, and also they had like hip hop and electronic, and then jazz. I did a jazz show for like one semester, but I still don't know much about jazz. But even though I like had encountered electronic music during like my whole life, right, but like I wasn't really like interested in the rave scene at all. And I learned a little bit about through like joining the hip hop and electronic departments, because they had, you know, you had us listen to all the classic stuff and be like, oh, write about it and like, what do you think? Same with the punk department. But after and I always had these friends who were in both and would be like, yo, come to this rave. And like, I was in Boston. So they're like, come to Dorchester, like Dorchester Art Project. There's a rave happening. And then I'm like, ah, it's fine. I really regret not going. But fast forward to the pandemic, I saw, I think, a bunch of these online raves happening. And since I was, you know, terminally online, I was like, oh, this is cool. Like, this rave in Second Life. I think that actually the first thing I watched that was like, I was like, what the fuck is this shit? It was like the Limp Pumpo rave. It's kind of like 2000 and like early pandemic, they were doing these Second Life raves. Just super like deep fried music and like really stupid. And and then I was listening to like these mashups by, I think Check Disc is the name, or like, I think also goes by Dick Soak, or like Weed Hitter on on Twitter. I don't know, just that's kind of like really stupid, honestly, like kind of like disrespectful music. But then like I started listening to more, and then actually I did a class about community development, and I wrote a paper about Detroit and sort of the relationship of techno to like the development of the city and the like maybe underdevelopment of the city as well. In its early days. And I mean, it was a really shitty paper, and I didn't know anything about Detroit techno, but I just like watched some like documentaries, like, oh, this is cool. Like, so like my entry into that was through like, yeah, Detroit techno and like early house music. I really wanted to learn. This was like around the time of, I guess, yeah, like that summer was the George Floyd uprising. So we did some fundraisers and like highlighting the like history of dance music, because like I think before I like encountered all this stuff about the rave scene, and also, you know, the origins in black and people of color, like LGBT venues and communities, I was just like, dance music is just EDM. It's like stuff Asians do at raves, like,
which is,
you know, like obviously not true. So I was really interested in this history and origins of dance music and electronic music in struggle and in the margins, which I had always thought was like, you know, that's punk, but like that's a very like narrow-minded way to think about it.
I feel like, like when you said that EDM thing, I feel like that's such a powerful reflection of growing up in Orange County.
Like I thought it was all just like, I remember I had this one friend that would, and now they all go to raves, but we would just like smoke in their car, listen to Trendsetter by some, I think it's whatever. It's like, we're like, whoa, this is crazy music. Like, and like smoking and like, But actually, no, now I think about it. No, I did like some electronic music before, way before, because I played Team Fortress 2 like back in middle school. And like, that's when I encountered Pendulum for the first time. Because they would like have those that music during like, they'd put out the background music for like compilation videos or stupid like memes. So like, I guess through memes and like through gaming, I encountered drum and bass and I was like, this is crazy. And then a little, like I listened to dubstep a little bit, obviously through that, like, but I thought it was kind of a meme back then. And it's, I guess it still is like bro step. But now, like, I know what, like, real dubstep is. anyways. So, yeah, I guess my progression has been encountering stuff through memes and then finding the real stuff and, like, learning more about it.
What were the kind of avenues for learning more of the context of dance music, like... Where did you learn about these histories? I guess you were saying partially through that class.
Yeah, well, that class was very not related to dance music, but I kind of just was doing this.
You weaved it in.
Yeah, I kind of like shoehorned it in because it was just, it was like an urban, it was at the like graduate school of design kind of thing, like urban planning. Like people were taking this. I'm just like there because I was like, oh, I think it's cool. I guess mostly the documentaries at first, I was working with this one producer slash DJ back then, a lot doing online shows, and his name's Dirty Bird, and he would compile all these resources specifically about like house music and like techno. So I would read up, I'd like read Dweller, I read like, I watched random like documentaries and that kind of stuff. Yeah, and then yeah, I guess stuff like that, or just Googling, Wikipedia, rate your music, blurbs, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I feel like Dweller is such a good resource. And then I'm really bummed that Red Bull Music Academy's editorial died. Yeah, because it was really good. It had so many things from lectures to like the historical stuff was all really good. When did you start finding, finding out about Asian diasporic music in general, whether it's like electronic or like otherwise?
So, okay, so there's two like threads there then. So when I, and this I guess ties back to how I got started writing too, but when I was in freshman year in the summer, I was in Japan for that summer, just doing some random internship, but I was mainly there because I wanted to be in Japan, obviously. Like, oh my god, it'd be sick to live in Japan for a summer. So I went, and then I was curious about the music scene there. I knew a few bands because of like being a weeb, and also just I knew a few bands that were big, but I didn't know anything about the local music scene. So I got curious and was just like looking it up, and then I didn't have like shows in Japan are really expensive, so I was like trying to figure out how I could go and maybe use the fact that I did college radio to my advantage. So I ended up like writing a bunch of emails to these venues and being like, hey, I'm like writing a blog for like this college radio station in America, like do you want to give me a press pass? And then I had my friend translate it, and that it worked for like a lot of them.
Nice.
And then I was able to like just see a bunch of shows and like see a bunch of local stuff that, yeah, looking back, none of it was like actually super groundbreaking, but like it was just really cool for me to go and experience a music scene, because I had actually before that had never experienced like a local music scene, whether it was in America or mm. Asia, because I didn't really go to shows unless it was like someone I really knew. Like my first show was Tame Impala. yeah.
What kind of music were you seeing in Japan?
Mostly like run-of-the-mill indie pop. Yeah, indie rock. I'm trying to think. There's like some folk artists that were really cool that played at this really kind of unplugged space. I think it's called Mona Records. But that was really, really nice. And then I saw... And the main one I knew beforehand that I wanted to see was Indigo La End. And they're like huge, but it was really funny because it was the first time I went to a show like with a lot of people in Japan, and the way they like appreciated the music was so different without being like orientalizing. But yeah, it was just so crazy to me that people would just like kind of stand still, and then like once the chorus would go, like the chorus would hit, they would start like doing, I don't know how to describe it. They would just like wave their hands like all in unison, like open up their fist, like have a fist and open it up, open a fist and open whoa. It up, like whoa. But then like, you know, it's not obviously every concert's like that. Like there was the crazy like jazz rock, kind of jazzy, kind of mathy stuff that was happening. There's this band, I don't think it exists anymore, but this band called Manhole New World, and like that went, it went really crazy. And people were like almost moshing and that kind of stuff. And there's also a shoegaze, actually. One of my favorites was this shoegaze show. No one, like barely anyone was there, but it was this, at this place called High in Koenji. And yeah, I just kind of like, I was like, whoa. My first time seeing like that kind of music live, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I guess this is around the time I was really into Mitski. So she was probably the first Asian American artist that I was really... a big fan of and like aware of in that way. We like talked about identity. Fast forward to 2019, I went to South by Southwest to like report on it for the radio station. I met a bunch of Taiwanese indie bands there, and that was really cool. And I actually made me want to apply to a grant to go to Taiwan for a few weeks and make a zine. So I like just went for a few weeks and went to shows, like talked to people, took photos, and I made this like little risograph scene. I ended up making it was like maybe a year in the making, but I ended up making the zine and then started being more interested in like the Taiwanese indie scene and also the Chinese, mainland Chinese indie scene. I had this interest in Japan as well from when I was there, but this is all like I guess places I'd been to. Then fast forward to when I was learning about dance music, I think. I forget if it was Eternal Dragons that I found first or Eastern Margins, but like somehow like through the internet, you know, you just like find stuff, and like that's where I kind of got my interest in really digging into these scenes and thinking about them in maybe a more analytical way. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I also had this friend in New York, shout out Wynn, but he's a DJ and producer, but he goes by like Windows XP or NXP. He sort of put me onto Nyakke as well, and yeah, I guess that. And then I felt for me it just felt like all these sort of currents and threads coming together, and then that's also when I started actually writing for money for Bandcamp and like The Wire. And this all sort of happened after I had graduated, so yeah, very, very recently actually, but I try to educate myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess, like, in terms of dance music, when did you first get to experience it live?
Yeah. So throughout the whole pandemic, right, it was all these online things, but I was in New York in 2021. So right before I moved to Korea, I just graduated. I got like a part-time job that was remote. So I was just like working for this like Asian American organization. So I was like, I want to go to like New York. And my friend happened to have an open room in his apartment. So I just went, and this is before everything had opened up. But then around May, mid-May, like stuff, you know, BASA did it, like the BASA radio series. So that was actually the first club I went to. It was Bossa Nova Civic Club.
Nice.
Before actually,
that's a good intro.
Like, before it actually reopened, so it was really cool. Like, you could technically not dance; you just like stand there, like with your mask, and listen to. I think the first one I went to, like DJ Swisha was playing, and I didn't realize you can actually dance. So I was like kind of like bobbing my head pretty aggressively, and then like the dude who worked there was like, "No, like chill." I was like, "Oh shit, my bad."
Was that like a New York law or something?
Yeah, this is. I mean, before clubs are technically reopened, so there was like it was like a radio broadcast or like a podcast kind of thing.
Okay, gotcha.
And then I guess I would go to the lot and stuff, but then like June 1st, 2021, they reopened everything, and it's sort of like the floodgates had reopened. Like, there's this huge energy in the scene in New York that I was sort of like really blessed to experience firsthand. Like, yeah, before that, there were also like rooftop things in May, like pretty that were chill. And I guess there was like pandemic raves, like plague raves, but I didn't go to any of those. And then, but yeah, like after June 1st, I was like, all the clubs had reopened, like line for 3 hours at Mood Ring before midnight. Like, I was like, why, like looking back, like why did I even like wait in that line? Like, I'm never waiting in a line for Mood Ring again. Like, but I mean, it was like crazy. Everyone wanted to go out, everyone wanted to play. Like, so this is before I started DJing, and yeah, I went to all the like Bushwick haunts, I guess, just following around the DJs. I was like fanboying over through the pandemic. Yeah.
And then when did you start getting into DJing?
It was that summer as well. I mean, there's all this energy, and with Pirate Studios, like you can just rent a room and it's just like karaoke, but for DJing. And there's all these like referral deals happening because, you know, things were cutting back, I guess, and people wanted to DJ again. So my friend and I, like we all referred each other, our friend group, and we just like rent studio time. And just like fuck around on the CDJs. I bought a USB, like I like download a record box, and like, yeah, I just started DJing the stuff. I mean, so I guess I had been DJing for radio,
right, because of college.
For college, right. Yeah. And then I wanted to continue that during the pandemic. So I actually continued that until after I graduated. So I couldn't do college radio anymore, but I did online radio. I'd been listening to Datafruits and following their online parties. They're like DJ supermarkets. So I just sort of sent them like an application or whatever, and started doing dance focused mixes for them. So that was when I was downloading stuff, YouTube MP3, maybe some stuff on Bandcamp, just kind of putting it together on Ableton. And then every week or every other week, just sort of doing these shows. Which is really, really fun. And I think that was honestly also really important to this like whole arc for me.
Yeah. The continuation into like this DJ thing.
So then I was like, well, I've been doing these like online parties. I want to do something in person. Or just like, you know, see what it's like to just mix on a real deck. So I went with Wynn to like Pirate a bunch of times. Like, and it was really fun. And then, yeah, I guess I was just doing random shit, like really small gigs that either my friends were like inviting me to, or I would just like, because actually I didn't realize this, but it's so super easy to set up your own thing in New York, especially at a smaller venue. You just like email them. And so I was like, I set up some stuff at Wonderville, like some like video game themed stuff. And eventually some of my friends had been in touch with Mood Ring. So we got like a Wednesday night sometime in August last year, and like just played that. And, you know, like, Wednesday night in New York is about as packed as a Friday or like a Saturday here here in Korea. It was crazy. So, yeah, I was very surprised at, like, the response, and it just felt so good to play. So I just kept on doing it.
Nice. And then how about Korea? How long have you been in Seoul?
Almost exactly a year, coming up on a year.
Yeah. How has that been in terms of music stuff for you?
Oh, it's been great, I think. I was able to, so there was this big wave of energy in New York, right, when last year around this time, and I went to my first warehouse rave, nightclub, and that was crazy. But then when I came here, it was kind of like going back to a pandemic situation, or like a lockdown situation.
Yeah, it wasn't open back
but
then.
When I got out of quarantine, they had just like lifted all those restrictions. I got super lucky with everything. Like, after I got quarantined, I went to this all-night party at Modeshi, which was like DJs but also bands. It was really lucky because I could experience that wave of energy all over again in Korea. And, like, people were excited to meet people again. And, like, so I was able to, like, just really quickly meet a lot of really, really cool DJs and just people who are related to the arts here and the scene here. Literally the first week I got out of quarantine, I met Park Da-hong. So that's, like, I was at, like, Cosmos Wholesale to buy the Eun Lee Rice zine. And, yeah, I was like, oh, my God. You're the Park Da-hong. And yeah, you know, that's was just funny. Going to a lot of stuff and kind of laying low. I didn't want to come in like, oh, I'm this DJ. Like, I'm like DJ all the time. Like, I want to get a bunch of gigs, like, and take away space. I was just kind of soaking it all in.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess my first gig here was at Seoul Community Radio, actually. So nice. Yeah, that was maybe in December of last year.
I've heard like some stuff about Seoul's music scene. How would you compare it to New York?
I feel like it's like, I think actually it's interesting because the underground is very, there's a lot more presence of industry in the underground, and art, because, you know, they have all these grants for artists, and like also, you know, like it's really hard to be a musician in Seoul in Korea. So, like, out of necessity, a lot of people apply for like artist grants, or so I guess there's that part of the scene that's like kind of really connected to the industry and art world. And so you'll have like underground artists who are like no really famous people, or like they collaborate with really, everyone knows each other in music, even though like they might not be huge internationally or even that big in Korea. But there's also a lot of overlap between the band, some bands, and but it all happens in different regions of Seoul. So like you have like Hongdae, which is historically like bands, and then Ulsido, which is sort of this, I like to call it like the, it kind of feels like the Korean Bushwick, but it's like this industrial area that's like being gentrified. That's a lot of bands, but also sort of like hardcore, really noisy stuff. Noise shows will be there too. And then they have like Itaewon, which is like the traditional like clubbing area, which isn't like Gangnam. Like, I never go to Gangnam because like, yeah, it's just gross. But like Itaewon is where, you know, you have the US military base. You'll have like, it's like, or like, it, I guess that's like, not there anymore, or they're trying to get rid of it, but it's sort of the expat area, so there's a lot of the expat DJ scene is around there. There is also like this added dynamic of like expats and places where you'll see a lot of like white people or like other foreigners versus like places where you pretty much like only see Koreans. Whereas in New York, I guess there's a similar divide between like Manhattan being like this bougie kind of like area, and sometimes people venturing out there for gigs and like for the bag, but Bushwick being more like quote unquote underground.
We were talking before this about finding community on the internet, and then also that progression from URL to IRL. And I guess starting with Seoul, is that how you met people?
Mm.
And then talking more broadly about what that has meant to you.
Yeah, I think it was honestly like a combination of all of that, yeah, that we talked about. Because, like, yeah, I would go to shows and just, like, kind of dance a lot. And then people would say hi to me, like, because I dance, like, kind of really hard and people maybe aren't used to that. Yeah, I made a lot of friends just, like, at parties. But then I also, you know, had all these friends that I, or, like, people I knew from Instagram or, like, for example, Park Da-ham, I found out about actually through the Quick Die streams that he was doing with Kato Massacre in Japan. And then, so I had all these artists I was following from that. And then I never knew who anyone was because I was just like, but I was like, oh, wait, you're that artist. Like, oh, shit, I follow you because of that stuff. So yeah, it's just a combination of everything. But especially during the pandemic, I was meeting people online for the first time, actually, and like actually forming connections. For example, through the Eternal Dragons Discord, or even just like through Rate Your Music Discords for like, there's this one called like for Japanese indie called J Indies, and I met like a dude in Singapore that I haven't met yet, but like it's like really cool, like runs a label. I met Jimmy, who DJ Tespia, who has been a very strong supporter of my like Maple Story rave party quest. And we met in New York, actually. And then the craziest full circle thing was, I think, back in New York, I wanted to make my own music. So, and I encountered another person on rateyourmusic.com. And I was like, I was on this high of like, oh, I've been meeting so many cool people on the internet. So I wanted to like reach out and like, because I saw that done like covers of Midair Thief and like all these really cool artists and shoegaze artists. So I sent a message on RYM and like, hey, you want to collab on something? We ended up sending tracks, WAV files to each other, and like it never really amounted to anything, but we kind of stayed in touch. Yeah. And she's actually Korean American. Fast forward to like literally 2 months ago, a bunch of these Korean bedroom musicians who like got really popular abroad. Like Paranoid, Asian Glow, and like their friends, they think it's like shoegaze revival stuff. They did a show, and actually, because the friend that I met on Discord had like released an EP or album, or her debut album, and it picked up with those like circles as well. Like she actually came to Korea to play a show, their very first show, which was like sold out in like 8 minutes, and it was really really cool to see. Like they filled out the Rolling Hall in Hongdae, which is a pretty significant venue. And yeah, I just felt that like afterwards there was like an after party, and then like because like my friend from the States didn't have many friends out here besides like maybe one or two from like school or like family and who wouldn't really be interested in this kind of thing, she told me like, oh, invite like whoever. So I invited like my DJ friends like who really love like shoegaze and like all that stuff, and it was just really fun. Like felt like a really full circle like meeting of all the worlds that have been kind of separate maybe for me. And
yeah,
internet friends are great.
Yeah, I've been thinking about your piece on organ tapes for Bandcamp, and it was really interesting to read how you were thinking about identity, Asian American, Asian diasporic identity as a Chinese American person living in Korea. And I'm curious what sort of maybe how you'd been thinking about identity before you moved to Korea, and now what new avenues that has opened up for you in terms of thinking about your identity.
Yeah, so I guess before college, and even like for the first 2 years, I was sort of, you know, I had the typical model minority vision of Asian Americanness. And I didn't really know much about the history of the term at all. So then, yeah, obviously, like, in college, then I took some Asian American classes, Asian American, like, studies classes, and started connecting more with that history and, like, doing stuff in Chinatown and Boston, connecting it more to, like, a political identity as well.
Right.
But then when I came here, it kind of all changed. Because, you know, you're not in an American context anymore, and there's not this, like, I felt like I was running away from it all. Just wanted to not think about it for a while. It was interesting because people would just forsake me for Korean, because I guess I like a little bit Korean. Like, so they would speak to me in Korean and then be like surprised. I'm like, oh, wait, I thought you were Korean. Sorry. And I'd be like, sorry, I can't speak Korean. And I would always be like super like, damn, I need to speak Korean. Like, I don't want to keep talking to people in English and having this like moment where of confusion. But I was also really happy with how I could just move around and not be, just be another face in the crowd. I felt similarly when I was in Taiwan, actually, doing my zine project. So I came here and with an awareness of inter-Asian relations more so than like Asian white or like black white or like, you know, American, American dynamics. Because actually, Chinese, not Chinese ethnic Koreans, but Korean ethnic people who grew up in China. There's like a derogatory term for them here, actually. There is like these racial dynamics that are really interesting and that I really don't have a context for. But for me, I was just like, it feels nice to like move around and blend in, and like people will mistake me for Korean. And it actually felt kind of cool. Like I can just, I'm like kind of incognito. I don't know how to describe it really, but yeah, just being able to like forget about all the like stuff, especially with post-Atlanta, the really cringy and corny like Asian American stuff that came out of that as well, and just be like, yeah, I'm here in Korea and I'm fake Korean.
It also reminds me too, when we talked, when we did the interview for Eternal Dragons, we were talking about identifying more with Asian diaspora than Asian American.
Yeah. I think.
I don't know if you had more thoughts on that.
Definitely. I remember reading on somewhere on the internet, it's like turning, like, go back to your country into like, yeah, hell yeah, I'll go back to my country. It fucking sucks here, anyways, right? Like. And I actually found that like kind of empowering, like, yeah, connecting with like roots or even like imagined roots or like fake roots. Like, I'm here in Korea, coming from America, it's a very privileged position, right? Like, you can have this mobility, and being American in Korea has its own like power dynamic, right? So as, you know, Asian diaspora, there is this room to like move. And also from being a certain class background, there is this room to move around and like adopt these different identities or like kind of blend in. Because I can blend in Taiwan, I can blend in Korea, I can blend in. Even in Vietnam, people thought I was Vietnamese because I went for a week to write some articles. And I found that the whole idea of being in between, or like not Korean enough for Korea, not Chinese enough for China, not like American enough for America. You kind of hear that a lot, but I think that's actually doesn't have to be a source of angst, or like doesn't have to be a source of like, it's actually a very privileged position to be in, because then you can go between those contexts and you have access to these things that otherwise you wouldn't. If you don't feel connected to this identity or that, like, I mean, identity in general is just fake, right? It's just in I guess the liberal sense, you just share these like connection to consumables, like K-drama, like music. Yeah. So I felt like if I have my friends tell me what's the K-pop that people know, or like, what do people find nostalgia in? I guess I'm a very nostalgia-driven person, so I was really interested in like digging through like other people's nostalgia here and connecting it and like making it my own. And then that sort of made me feel really comfortable here.
Yeah, there's like, there's a fluidity, like thinking about not being enough for this space or not enough for that space, like it's true.
Yeah.
It actually means there's a fluidity in how you can adopt what you want in a sense.
Exactly. And it's sort of, I think Asians are in this unique position where, and I guess white people have it too. You know, if you're Italian, you could probably pretend if you're to be like English or something. I don't know. But yeah, I think because of that, like you can, you know, go between these contexts and also go to America and, you know, be Asian American. And that's really cool too. But I think I had all these anxieties in America when I moved to Orange County because I was like, oh, I don't know K-drama. Like, what is this stuff? Like, I was like, oh, am I Asian enough? Like, these guys are so Asian. Like, but then I realized, like, oh, that's like, it doesn't matter. Like, you can just learn about K-pop if you don't know about K-pop. You can, like, you can learn Chinese if you, like, don't know Chinese. Or, like, you can try to, like, connect with these aspects of your culture that it's never too late.
I feel like it's also really interesting how, I don't know if it's true in other contexts, but at least for Asian American identity, it's, especially thinking about the Californian context, it's really tied to what you consume. Like boba, K-drama, K-pop, or 88 Rising. This kind of
raving.
And then maybe
or like EDM,
like EDM.
EDC. Tomorrowland. It's very different from, you know, the original political identity that happened in like the 70s, right? Or that arose in the 70s. And and like also talking to Gyokpo who live here, it's like also like Korean Americans or like diaspora Koreans who live here, it's interesting too because some people, like, I feel like sometimes I'm more comfortable living here than Gyokpo, right? Because I don't, even if I'm not Korean, right, like for someone who's Korean, it's like an existential crisis, but for me it's like, yeah, I'm Chinese. It doesn't really matter for me. Like, I'm, someone's like, you're not Korean, like, yeah, I'm not Korean. Like, I can never be not Korean enough for Korea because, like, I'm Chinese. But at the same time, I can still adopt some sort of Korean identity by, like, having this relationship to music or people or connection with the history. And I think learning more about, like, the Chinese-Korean connection is interesting, too. And, like, you know, relationship and contradictions. Korea with Japan, obviously, with colonialism, and Korea with like Vietnam. When I was there, I was thinking about all these things, and like, it was really cool to watch Decision to Leave. I don't know if you've seen it yet, but it's Park Chan-wook's real new film, and it's sort of this love story between this Chinese woman and a Korean dude. Like, at the, like, obviously there's a lot more context, but like, it goes a little bit into, like, you know, the entanglements that were between these Asian countries that, like, you don't really know about in America, right? But that really complicate how you view identity and how you view, like, maybe politics in the Asian context. And I think learning, like, I think it's just really fascinating and a source of, a different source of, like, intra-Asian ways to think about identity that, like, you just don't know, like, I never knew about in America.
It's kind of weird in America, too, because there can be, like, that, those residual memories of those tensions between Asian countries.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
It's, like, the parents or grandparents who are, like, I don't like Korean people or I don't like Japanese people. But at the same time, the kids are all intermingling with each other a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
There's like that weird tension.
Yeah. And it's interesting too. I met a friend who is from Brazil, actually. She's Korean Brazilian. The like tensions between Korean Brazilians and Japanese Brazilians is like crazy there too.
Whoa, so, really?
I just thought it was interesting that like this, yeah, these aspects of like history like kind of overlap, and like identities can feel, and connection to land like is so connected to history, but also like contested and and intermingling and overlapping and like, yeah. So I was thinking about that a lot. should we talk about the mix? Or are we?
Yes, we should talk about the mix next time. It was really fun for me because I think this collision of video game OST aesthetics with blends with different club music stuff like hardcore and all these things was really fun. And I'm curious where you got the inspiration to do that. I remember talking to EXO, and they were saying actually like their entry point to dance music was through video game and anime soundtracks. Can't remember, maybe like Yoko Kanno. I don't remember their reference points. But yeah, I'd like to know for you how you got the idea or what you were thinking about. And also the video game references in it and like your memories of it.
Yeah, like my first, now that I think about it, my first introduction to dance music was probably like DDR, playing that at friends' houses, or they had like a gym class for some reason. It was like crazy.
Whoa.
So, but you know, I never really got super into it. I mean, I've always loved video games, especially JRPGs. I mean, those soundtracks don't really have as much like dance music influence per se, but knew I wanted to do this because I love like video game OST or JRPG OST, to combine them in some way. Even before I did this mix, I'd done these MapleStory raves online, and as I said before, nostalgia is something that I really like cling on to, not in like a weird way, but maybe it is weird, I don't know, but I just like really, I think something, I'm drawn to like nostalgia.
That's natural.
Yeah.
That's very natural. Yeah.
Well, I was always thinking about how I could really combine these things that, yeah, are very different, right? JRPG OST is sort of like very melodic and not very percussive. I don't know where I came up with the, I think I was thinking about how I could connect them all, or like a theme at least, like, so it wouldn't just be video game music plus dance music. What I didn't want it also was like dance music that was in video games, because like, you know, that's sort of, you know, Street Fighter or like Bomberman, like that's sort of been done as well. Maybe I was feeling very like loving, but I was like, oh yeah, like like love themes are a huge thing in JRPGs. There's always like a love theme or like that plays during like emotional moments. I figured like, why not just like match those up with various DJ tools and like kind of, because there's also like that strand of like crying in the club music, like, you know, emotional trance music, you know, like, so I wanted to like just put those together and see what could come out of it. And it was, yeah, it worked out a lot better than I thought. And I was just like, wow, this is, I think this is my best mix ever. But when I was making it, yeah, because, you know, I guess JRPG OSTs are like melodic, not very percussive. They actually fit very well with like just DJ tools and like percussive tracks that don't have much melody. So that's what I sort of did. And the way it starts is, and way it ends, I think, is very intentional for me. I just remember Xenoblade being the one thing that I like had like known about before everyone like started hopping onto it, and like it was a big part of my life in middle school, because I was like, you know, I heard about it in like maybe 2008 2009 as a new JRPG that's coming out for the Wii. It looks really cool. Back then it was called like Monado, Beginning of the World, not like Xenoblade. And but it ended up, when it actually got announced, it didn't end up getting released in the West, so So there's this huge like campaign that I remember being like emotionally invested in called Operation Rainfall that like I would like was bringing it to the West, and like I downloaded the soundtrack. I was like listening to it every day. Like I developed all these like, you know, memories with that even before playing the game. And then finally it came out in Europe because America didn't want to localize it for some reason. And then I, you know, I downloaded the ROM. I played it on my like soft modded Wii. And Operation Rainfall was actually three games, like Xenoblade, The Last Story, and Pandora's Tower. The Last Story was that I was really interested in because Nobuo Uematsu did the soundtrack. So the mix begins with Xenoblade's like main theme and then ends with The Last Story's main theme. Just sort of as an homage to that sort of that time. Some that I like, just really like this OST for, or haven't gotten around to playing. But yeah, I mean, I'm just like looking at the track list right now, and
yeah. What are some of your favorites?
So Xenogears and Xenoblade, definitely my favorite. Like Xeno series is one of my favorite series. So Xenogears soundtrack, like Yasunori Mitsuda, I feel like can do no wrong. So Xenogears, Chrono Cross, Chrono Trigger. Those are like some of my favorites that are in here. My favorite moments are like Chrono Cross moment when I blend that with Alp tracks, like one of her her tools. Yeah, there's like a way that the vocal and the Chrono Cross soundtrack interplays with the like different percussive things that just feels so like, I get chills every time. And that was, all this was pretty much an accident. I was just like, oh, what about this with this? Like, let's see it. And then I was like, oh my God.
I love that.
Yeah, and... forget which producer it is, like weird internet producers who like have weird monikers. I think it's like just a bunch of numbers or something, but they did a mashup of Haikyuu soundtrack with Future. And it's just like the most emotional thing, like the saddest thing you could ever like imagine. So I kind of took a page up from that book and mashed up Corridors of Time from Chrono Trigger, or like a remix of that, and Champions by like Ye and Travis Scott, Quavo. Like it's like that one song with like a bajillion features. And it's like really, really fun. But in that context, it's almost like sad.
Oh yeah, that's such a good moment.
And then it actually worked really well as I like to blend right into like Viren's track, because I don't know, as soon as like the rapping gets more intense, like and fast, like Jay-Z's like and with the breaks that Viren has, it's just, that's fun. Yes, I mean, there's a lot of Final Fantasy in here. I've played most of those. Chrono Cross, Chrono Trigger. Yeah, and also a lot of DS games, right? Because I think my height of when I was getting into JRPGs was when I had this R4. You could download games and like put it onto an SD card and play it on your DS. So just a lot of random like JRPGs on the DS I had played. A lot of them didn't make it into the mix, but that's sort of like the aesthetic.
Nice. Would you say like with video games, was that more, I guess like especially JRPGs, were they more of a solitary experience for you?
Yeah, definitely. I think I only really started breaking out of my shell and later in high school and in college, but I played League, right? And I played MapleStory and that was fun. But I think for me, gaming has always been sort of a solitary thing.
Yeah.
For, just like experiencing the story, and had a lot of crushes growing up. So I think the love theme thing was very like back to my naive days of like connecting, like feeling so many feelings when like with Renoa and Squall, like all these like fictional loves, like romances. I'm like, oh my God, this is so like, wow. Like true love exists, and it's just like these pixels on a screen. Like honestly, to this day, it's like really moving, the reincarnation story of the fact that there's like these two people who are like literally destined to like meet and like fall in love every time they're reincarnated. It, like really, really, really drew me. I guess I have another like thing for reincarnation. But
Yes. Before we go, do you want to share where people can find you, like on socials?
So I'm at ZKGUI on Instagram, and I think SoundCloud as well. And there's an underscore somewhere in there for Twitter. You can find my writing on Bandcamp if you just search it up. Bandcamp Daily, James Gui, GUI, or The Wire if you're subscribed. And if you're in Korea, I also DJ as DJ Hot Pot. Yeah, that's it. Thanks for having me on the show. I mean, it's been really kind of a full circle moment for me, is like finally doing a mix that's like very important to me. So really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was such a good mix, and this was a really nice conversation. And then for Eternal Dragons, we're on Instagram, SoundCloud, Twitter, Bandcamp. It's all Eternal Dragons with a Z. And yeah, thanks to each and every one of you listening in. This has been Smoking Section. until we meet again.